Occasionally, one could get the impression that the world is divided between DSM and ICT culture. Although I acknowledge that for research, DSM is the main and only force so far. For other purposes, clinical ones and teaching ones, many countries in the world orient themselves after the ICD. And I have the honor today to share two subsequent symposia. The first one will be on core disorders of the group of stress-associated disorders for the planned ICD-11. And the second one, subsequent, same room, after 15 minutes break, will be on the remaining disorders of this new group. I have to announce that two of our international speakers are not able to be here for different reasons. For the second of this second symposium, Ashraf Kagi from South Africa and his paper on prolonged grief will be read by another member of our working group. The same is true for Asma Humayun from Pakistan, Islamabad. She is not able to come here, and her paper will be read by Chris Bruin. So now I'd like to ask the first speaker, Michael First from New York, from Columbia University, to give his first presentation on what was going on, what is still going on with the ICD-11 process.
Thank you, Andreas. So what we're going to be really talking about during this symposium today is the section on trauma for the ICD-11. Now, for most people here, I assume, are from the United States, so everybody's been pretty focused on the big DSM-5 revision. But there is another system and another revision going on in parallel, and that's ICD-11. And ICD-11 will be coming out in a few years. I'm going to start by just giving you some idea about what is going on with that revision. Let's see how I get this started. Where's the slide sorter thing? Is it this thing here?
Is it here? Here?
No. Is there a way to get this so that you have all the you don't see all the slides on the bottom? I'm sorry. It's up here. It's fine on the screen. Okay, I understand. It's up here. Okay, great. Sorry about that. Okay, so let me. Apparently, I need to read this first before we start out the commercial disclosure requirement. So I have the following commercial relationships to disclose. I'm on the faculty of the Lundbeck International Neuroscience Foundation. I've been a consultant to Roche, and I get book royalties from the American Psychiatric Association and from Wiley Blackwell. Okay, so let me just quickly start out by talking about some of the revision principles for ICD-11. This will be, I think, gone into more detail by Andreas a little bit later. So the first thing is to remember is that the audience for the ICD-11 is slightly different than the audience for the DSM-5. The highest goal for the ICD-11 is to help WHO member countries reduce disease burden of mental disorders. So it's a slightly different audience. The world disease burden of mental disorders with different types of clinicians working in different types of settings is a different type of system and has different requirements that you could imagine a book like the DSM, which is designed for use in the United States and other fairly industrialized countries. And as such, the focus on ICD-11 more so, even though DSM is primarily for clinicians, the overriding principle for ICD-11 is a focus on clinical utility. And the idea is to be able to facilitate identification and treatment by global frontline health workers. And it must be undertaken in collaboration with the various stakeholders of the ICD-11, which is, again, very different. The individual countries in a sense, are the most important audience because the WHO serves its member countries as well as healthcare professionals, service users and consumers, and families. So let me tell you a little bit about some of the features of the ICD-11 revision and how it actually pertains to this section on trauma. And one of the things is that ICD-11 is being implemented not as a book as it was before in this age of computers. It's actually being implemented in a hierarchical database that reflects the hierarchical nature of the classification. And every disorder, and this is also another big change. Historically, if you look at previous editions of the ICD, the only section of the ICD that had definitions was the mental disorder section. The rest of the ICD, if you open it up and you look at infectious diseases or cardiology, you just have the names of the disorders, and it's up to the individual doctor to decide what myocardial infarction actually is, or hypertension, or anything else. Psychiatry has been the only historically area for which there are definitions. And in a way, it's reflected psychiatry not having objective lab tests and people not agreeing on terminology. So a way psychiatry has been in the forefront of identifying the problem that how you name something is very, very important in trying to get agreement on the naming is very, very important. So now the rest of medicine has come into line with psychiatry, and the big change for the rest of the ICD is to have definitions for all the conditions in all of medicine. So actually, for the ICD-11, the change from 10 to 11 is relatively minor, but for everybody else, it's huge. Everybody is coming up with new definitions. And this is all going to be entered into a big database. Now, here's this kind of a summary. Also now, again, because most of you are much more familiar with the DSM, this is a slide just to sort of compare, just as a fundamental sense, the differences between the ICD and the DSM. So, of course, that the DSM is produced by the American Psychiatric Association, which is a professional organization just within the United States, where the ICD is produced by the WHO, which is a global health agency of the United Nations. The entire DSM is the intellectual property of the American Psychiatric Association, and if that may not have that much impact on you as a clinician, but if you're an author writing a textbook or anything else, it's going to be a big issue because you have to get permission to use any of the criteria, whereas the WHO, the criteria and every aspect of the ICD is free. Theoretically, you have to request permission to use it from the WHO, but it's given freely. And the idea is to try to have this disseminated as widely as possible around the world for everybody's benefit. The primary audience of the DSM is psychiatrists and psychologists, whereas in the ICD, the primary audience is countries and frontline service providers. So it's got to be applicable for use in Africa and, you know, third world settings. It's a very, very different audience. ICD is global, multidisciplinary, and multilingual development. The work group, several members of the work group, in fact, from faraway places couldn't make it to the meeting, but the work groups and all of the ICD revision groups are from all over the world. There are some international members on the DSM-5, but that's actually a big change. DSM-4, it was completely U.S. and Canada. DSM-5 has a smattering of international membership, but it's still primarily a U.S. and certainly English-speaking operation. And then finally, the final approval of all of the disorders in the ICD, it's approved by the World Health Assembly, which is a body representing the entire world. Well, basically, the DSM-5 is approved by the American Psychiatric Association Board of Trustees. So it's really a different focus. Let me just quickly talk about the timeline for ICD-11. As people probably are aware, DSM-5 is coming out this May, 2013. ICD-11 is about 2 years behind the DSM-5. They started out roughly around the same time. In 2007 was appointment of the advisory group. And then the first draft of the proposals is just now available. This is the website. The WHO has a website where you can actually see the definitions of the disorders, not just for the mental disorder section, but actually for all of medicine. We're going to be doing field trials soon, 2000, It says 2012, 2013. It's probably going to be 2013, 2014. In fact, by the very last slide of the presentation, we invite you to participate in the field trials. Many of the field trials are going to be internet-based. And a lot of the field trials are going to be focusing on clinical utility, how you find the changes, the proposed changes, useful in your clinical practice. So the very last slide, we're going to give you the email address if you're interested in participating in an internet-based field trial. In fact, one of the first focused field trials is going to be on this section, the trauma and stress-related disorder section. So wait with bated breath for the last slide, and you'll have that information. And then finally, 2015 is when we expect the ICD-11 to be approved by the World Health Assembly. Now, one of the big changes between ICD-10 and ICD-11 is it sounds a little arcane because it's a coding issue, but it has a huge implication in the structure. The way the codes worked for ICD-10 is that they used the decimal system, so that basically meant there were only 10 chapters within the mental disorder section. So every one of the 200 or so mental disorders had to be shoehorned into one of 10 chapters, which was completely stuck by the fact that we have 10 fingers, so we have a decimal system. So the whole system was revolving around these 10 sections. And for that reason, we had to, things were really crammed together. Like there was one section, F4, that had neurotic, stress-related, and somatoform disorders. Now, one of the big changes is ICD-11 will no longer, especially in this day and age of computers, the idea of being stuck with only 10 characters is kind of out of date. So there's going to be 24. So here's just a quick example. This is what ICD-10 looks like, the 10 sections. And just one of note is you'll see F4, which is the neurotic, stress-related, and somatoform disorders, has phobias, panic, GAD, OCD, PTSD, adjustment disorders, dissociative disorders, somatoform disorders, and neurasthenia, just crammed in together. And one that's even crazier is F6, disorders of adult personality and behavior, which includes personality disorders, impulse control disorders, gender identity disorder, paraphilias, sexual orientation. Homosexuality is actually still in the ICD-10. That's going to be out for ICD-11. ICD-11 has a new chapter thing, which has 24 chapters. You can see we had the opportunity to break this down into things that made sense. And in fact, one of the areas of harmonization between DSM-5 and ICD-11 is the chapter structure. So DSM-5 and ICD-11, while the categories may not be that similar, and when you hear today about the categories for ICD-11, I think people will probably comment on some of the differences with the DSM-5, but the chapter structure is going to be very similar. So these are the structure. And one of the big differences between DSM-4 and DSM-5 and ICD-10 and 11 is the groupings are also now, the rationale for grouping these together has been changed. In DSM-4 and ICD-10, the groupings were based primarily on presenting symptom. So you have this category in DSM-4 called anxiety disorders, and what was in the anxiety disorders? Things that patients presented with anxiety. That's what grouped them together. In DSM-5 and ICD-11, the principle now is based on common underlying etiological factors. So there's a new section on obsessive compulsive and related disorders, and that section it groups together disorders based upon this underlying common neurobiological factors that these disorders have in common. So let me just show you now. Let me focus specifically on disorders associated with stress. This is the difference between ICD-10 and ICD-11. As you can see, we now have a separate chapter in ICD-11 for disorders that the common factor is that stress is definitionally part of what goes into that chapter. So you can see what goes into the new chapter. You have the traumatic stress disorders, which include PTSD, prolonged grief disorder, adjustment disorder, attachment disorders. That's the old reactive attachment disorder that you see in children, which are brought up in institutional settings, and acute stress reaction, which is actually no longer a mental disorder in ICD-11. It's now considered to be a normal reaction to an extreme stressor, and that's why it's in italics. It's actually going to go in. There's a section in the ICD for things that people come into treatment for that aren't disorders. And another big difference between ICD-11 and DSM is there are no diagnostic criteria in ICD-11, at least right now. ICD-11 instead has these things called diagnostic guidelines, which are intended to provide clinicians with guidance on making the diagnosis and focus on the essential features. So that these paragraphs that are preceded by bullet points that summarize. The idea here is to encourage clinicians to use clinical judgment. It gives them some guidance on how to apply their clinical judgment, but the idea of having counting up symptoms and having pseudo-precise how many days and things like that, that's something that's being frowned upon for the ICD because that's not really useful clinically. Since I'm running out of time, I'm going to run up to this slide that I've been promising, which are ways to participate in the ICD-11 field study. So as I mentioned earlier, an important focus on ICD-11 is clinical utility, which means we need clinicians to participate in the ICD-11 field trials. So the way that's happening is they are creating a global practice network of clinicians around the world who are willing to participate in internet-based field studies. And one of the first areas that are going to be studied is the trauma and stress-related disorder. So we really would like anyone in the audience who has any, I assume if you decided to come to this session, you have some interest in the idea of the ICD classification. So in particular, this email address at the very end, it's Spencer Evans, and his email address is E-B-A-N, which is his last, Evans, which is his last name, evans@who.int. He's an employee of the WHO. If you could email him and say that you're interested in signing up for the Global Practice Network for the ICD-11 field trials. These will occur over the next couple of years. And basically, it should be something that's relatively not that time-consuming and will give you an opportunity to, I think the way these will be designed is they'll be presenting you the criteria, ask you to try it out in your own patients, and then provide feedback on how useful you find them. So I will stop here, and we will move on to the next, and then have questions at the end. Is that okay? So I will move on to the next presentation, and I think at the end there'll be an opportunity for questions. So thank you very much.
According to the printed program, I guess our next speaker will be Cécile Rousseau from Canada on the already mentioned attachment disorders, the childhood-related disorders in our group of trauma and stress-related disorders. So, do you know? Here it is, yeah.
Good afternoon. Attachment disorder are a bit an outlier in the stress disease disorder category. This afternoon, I want to address 2 points. One was one of the things Michael, well, the two things were mentioned by Michael before. It's one of the things is the difference between the ICD and the DSM is the wish to have a universal or planet utility. So I want to address a bit some of the questions which are raised by this goal, which is an ambitious goal. And the second thing that I want to make some remarks is clinical utility of attachment disorder. So I have no commercial disclosure. Okay, so what changes do we have from ICD-10 to ICD-11? Well, first we have a change in category. So the inclusion of disorder related to early relation disruption in stress-related disorders. So why and how is this change of category? Does it have anything or any meaning clinically or for our practice? I think first it's a shift associated with etiological assumption, and I'll go back to that in clinical utility. It means it's recognizing that attachment disorder are stress-related, are environmentally related, and this is important and should be regrouped with extreme other forms of extreme stress. So we speak of stress and trauma. Early relational disruption is a form of extreme stress, and so that's a first, I think, recognition of moving it into this category. Now, the category names, and I'll discuss it after, of the attachment disorder, are at midway between phenomenology, so describing what's happening to the child, and etiology, the source of provoking this kind of disruption. And then, yes, I will discuss clinical utility. So the first diagnosis, which will be there in ICD-11, is reactive attachment disorder. Used to be, so the changes are relatively minor with respect to ICD-10. It used to be reactive attachment disorder of childhood. So by suppressing the of childhood, there is the assumption that these disorders do persist in adult life and may have severe consequences. It do not mean that the diagnosis in adult life is neither easy or simple to do, and I think Marilyn in her presentation may allude to some of that. Symptoms are really close to what they were before, and in fact to what you have in DSM-5, so markedly disturbed and developmentally inappropriate attachment behavior, evident before 5 years of age in the context of pathogenic care. And I think this is important. So the stressor here is pathogenic care. Now, the second diagnosis, which will be in that classification, in that part of what I call attachment disorder, even if Professor Rutter may not agree, is a disinhibited social engagement disorder, which was previously disinhibited attachment disorder of childhood. Again, in terms of symptoms, the changes are minor. Main features is the child actively approaches and interacts with unfamiliar adults, always in the context of pathogenic care. So you see, we have two categories of diagnosis, which you also have in DSM-5, with minor changes in terms of their content of symptoms and the way you recognize them, and the main stressors is always pathogenic care. Now, one diagnosis was discussed by the work group and was not included, but I decided to allude to it because it's interesting in terms of clinical utility. Dr. Rutter proposed quasi-autism. What was proposed is the fact that you can have pseudo-autistic picture and patterns resulting from profound relational deprivation. And according to the group, to the childhood group, this was after profound institutional deprivation. And I thought that even if it's not to be included in the ICD-11, it is interesting in terms of differential diagnosis and in terms maybe of future development. It should, and it will be more research, to what extent profound relational deprivation can provoke a pattern of symptom, which is very difficult to differentiate, apart from evolution, from autism. Now, how are these related to context and culture? And I think that a number of these, the features in this diagnosis, are related to context and culture factors in the stressors themselves. First, we tend to speak about primary caregiver, and the singular is very Western. I think that in a lot of culture, we would speak of primary caregivers. So the question is, the model of attachment on which most of our research and diagnostic assumptions are based is Western, and do we have nuclear versus extended models of family to model attachment in childhood is the first question. Another thing which is context-related, profound deprivation having mainly document in institution within the literature. But how is it in other country, low-income country in particular, refugee camps and so on, where in fact you can find profound deprivation outside of institutional context? And I think this is another important thing in terms of context modifier. Severely traumatized parents, for example, can be and give and provoke pathogenic care, especially in a very adverse setting like war or refugee camps. Another context-related factor in stressor related to attachment is a co-occurrence, a lot of country, with malnutrition and exposure to toxic. Think of the prevalence of FES, fetal alcohol syndrome, in northern and Inuit population. It's sky high, very often in the context of pathogenic care. So how do you differentiate the added effect of these when they're really highly associated in for some communities? So research need to widen the assessment frame of these early relational stressors to take into account the complexity of their interaction. Now, moving to symptoms, so cultural and contextual question related to symptoms, cultural difference in marker of social reciprocity are important. Things that we consider like markers of early attachment, like eye contact, adult-child verbal interaction, physical interaction of care, like hugging and kissing, differs widely from culture to culture and may be at stake in the model of assessment of attachment-related disorder. Another source of cultural variations are culturally sanctioned social boundaries. Think of the disinhibited social engagement disorder. They also vary widely from context to context, calling other adults, for example, mommy or auntie, physical proximity, going to sit on somebody's lap. All these kind of culturally sanctioned boundaries vary a lot and raise questions in terms of assessment of the disorder. Finally, you also have, I would say, contextual difference in marker of social reciprocity. Children who have been raised in extremely adverse environment like concentration camps or Pol Pot camps learn certain forms of avoidance and social reciprocity, which also interact. So they may have other traumas, of course, than just attachment, but also this is transmittable, sometimes transgenerationally, and affect the way kids socially engaged. So what I wanted to show you is just that how these diagnoses may be universal, but their manifestation in terms of the stressors or in terms of the symptoms vary widely. What are rapidly some clinical implications of this? The shift of childhood disorder into the stress-related section put the emphasis on the stressors. I think this is important to decrease some misdiagnosis and, in particular, to raise awareness about differential, for example, with a PDD-related disorder. It's also quite important, I would say, to emphasize a public health perspective on prevention. If we want to prevent this attachment disorder, putting them in a stress section is a good idea because this kind of highlights the fact that this is and should be preventable. Now, there is a potential relation to stigma which needs to be considered. Pathogenic care does not occur in a vacuum. It directly points to the parents and to the family and is a highly stigmatized diagnosis, and this needs to be considered in terms of the impact of this diagnosis. And finally, the temporal dimension, so the evolution in adulthood of these two diagnoses is largely unclear and needs more attention. So I conclude with some more clinical implication. Context and culture-related features, although I discussed some of them, are overall largely understudied. Very often, they're put as not known, and not known usually means there is no robust evidence around that. And I would agree with the Cochrane collaboration position that clinical and qualitative data should inform clinical guidelines to ensure equity in representation of low- and middle-income countries when no robust evidence is available. So the whole idea, it's not because there's no randomized controlled trial on the cultural effects that we should not inform and try to give clinical guidelines on those aspects because this is important. So more research is clearly needed in this area. And finally, the complex relation between extreme stressor and attachment at all age needs to be more studied. And in particular, and maybe Marilyn will address that, the bidirectionality. So is extreme trauma in adult age, can it affect the attachment and not only the former attachment affect the trauma? I think we have a bidirectional relation, and this needs to be more studied. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cecile, for this very interesting presentation. Now, having dealt with the childhood disorders, now we move now to the adulthood disorders, and the first presentation will be on the core diagnosis of the whole group, and Chris will present on the PTSD concept for ICD-11. Are you better in...
Here's my disclaimer. Right. As we all know, PTSD has been not only an extremely valuable diagnosis, but also a very controversial one. And in particular, as DSM-4 has been the most prominent version of an attempt to capture what we mean by PTSD, it's been the one that's come in for a lot of criticism and debate so far. So I'd just like to sort of run over some of the issues that people have raised about it. The first thing is not really a criticism of DSM-4 at all, because any diagnostic system wrestles with the problem that we have no external or gold standard against which to define what these different disorders actually consist of. We have to base that on our own experience, on theoretical considerations, and on empirical data. But, for example, we know that in DSM-4, the three-symptom cluster structure has not been supported. Avoidance and numbing appear to be separate clusters. And also, it's not clear that these clusters belong to a higher-level entity that we can call PTSD. There's been a great deal of disagreement exactly about the stressor criterion, whether it's too narrow, whether it's too wide. And also, it's a complicated diagnosis. And this is particularly an issue as far as ICD is concerned. There are a lot of symptoms, there are a lot of rules, and somebody in some article claimed that there were nearly 80,000 valid combinations of symptoms which could qualify you for the diagnosis. I have to tell you, I haven't actually counted them all up myself. This figure may be very misleading. I wouldn't be surprised. But what I think we all are aware of is that comorbidity is extremely high. As I said, the clinical utility is reduced somewhat by the fact of the different symptom clusters, the different thresholds of symptoms, and there are controversies about can the diagnosis be meaningfully applied to other groups, particularly people who have various health conditions, such as cancer, for example. Now, the approach in ICD-10 has been somewhat different, and Michael first referred to some of these differences in the first talk. But for our purposes, one of the differences for PTSD is that there's no formal stressor criterion. There are only guidelines allowing clinicians to use their own judgment. So it's not the case that it has to correspond to one of a set number of experiences which are laid down. But the idea is that clinicians should be given enough information that they can make a judgment about whether it fits into this overall pattern or not. In ICD-10, there's also a much more explicit emphasis on the importance of re-experiencing. And the particular phrase that is used is re-experiencing in intrusive memories, brackets, flashbacks, dreams or nightmares. And another interesting thing is there's no impairment criterion of the kind that there is in DSM-4. What we can notice is that the ICD-10 version of the diagnosis has been much less influential in research. And what existing studies there are that have compared ICD-10 and DSM-4 diagnosis suggest that the ICD-10 version is somewhat more lenient or somewhat more easier to acquire than the DSM-4 version. Now, we can identify a number of specific problems with the ICD-10 version. For example, the phrase, the restriction to events which are likely to cause pervasive distress in almost everyone. I think there's now increasing recognition that rather than the objective characteristics of the event being the most important ones, the subjective reactions to events are also extremely important and should not be underestimated. The references to typical diagnostic features, rather than clearly distinguishing the essence of the disorder. So unlike the guidance that is given for disorders like OCD, panic, and so forth, there isn't an attempt to identify what is the essence of the disorder in quite the same way, although the importance of re-experiencing does go some way towards that. We now know that intrusive memories and flashbacks are not the same thing. We now know that intrusive memories occur in many other disorders, in probably most other psychiatric disorders, and they're not the same, they don't have the same re-experiencing qualities as we find in PTSD. ICD-10 also didn't put enough emphasis on the importance of active avoidance of symptoms and reminders, and there were some details about the course of the disorder that needed updating. So the proposals for ICD-11 were to update ICD-10 with more recent findings, to consider the importance of cultural variations and settings. And one of the aims that the working group set itself was to try to make the core features of the disorder more explicit, so as to simplify the diagnosis, to reduce the qualifying combinations of symptoms, to reduce comorbidity, and to provide a meaningful contrast with DSM-5 by addressing some of the perceived shortcomings, and to facilitate scientific research, and also to reintroduce an impairment criterion to address this issue of possible over-leniency relative to DSM-4 and DSM-5. Okay, now, perhaps before going on to the proposed definition, just to say that any diagnostic exercise is faced immediately with this problem about the lack of any external validation. If you're going to change things, what do you base that on? So it's, as I mentioned, it's based partly on theoretical views about that have been expressed in the literature about what is the core of PTSD. A lot of people have called it a memory disorder and would think that re-experiencing is, as in ICD-10, is one of the most important elements. Other people have chosen to favour numbing, for example, as the most important element. But there has to be some sort of theoretical commitment to the belief about what is the core element, drawing on available data, for example, results of factor analysis, attempts to identify what are the symptoms that discriminate PTSD best from other anxiety disorders and from depression. So to try to, to dissolve out what are the key aspects that are most characteristic of this disorder and differentiate it from others. And what the working group has proposed is that the disorder follows exposure to an extremely threatening or horrific event or series of events, and that it consists of three core elements, the first of which is re-experiencing, vivid intrusive memories, flashbacks or nightmares that involve re-experiencing in the present, accompanied by fear or horror. Second element, avoidance, marked internal avoidance of thoughts and memories or external avoidance of activities or situations reminiscent of the traumatic event. And C, hyperarousal, a state of perceived current threat in the form of hypervigilance or an enhanced startle reaction. The symptoms must also last for several weeks, although unlike as DSM-4, there's no specific cutoff of 4 weeks. That means that you can't give the disorder if you believe it's present before that time. And finally, the symptoms must interfere with normal functioning. So that's the impairment criterion that I mentioned. So in addition to this, there are some proposed diagnostic guidelines that try and spell this out in more detail. And these say the disorder follows an event or situation, either short or long-lasting, of an extremely threatening or horrific nature, including, but not limited to, the experiencing of natural or man-made disaster, combat, serious accident, torture, other forms of ill-treatment, rape and other forms of sexual violence, terrorism, assault or other crime, acute life-threatening illness, such as a heart attack, the witnessing in person of the threatened or actual injury or death of others in a sudden, unexpected or violent context, the confrontation with sudden, unexpected or violent death of a loved one. Sometimes there is a series of events that cumulatively lead to extreme threat of death or serious injury, such as being detained under harsh conditions, starvation, being stalked, proximity to repeated bomb attacks, or to extreme horror such as body handling. So again, trying to spell out for clinicians what are the kinds of experiences they should be looking for without being totally prescriptive about what does and does not count as a traumatic experience. Details provided about the first core element of re-experiencing, and these are the guidelines say that the events are not just remembered, but they are sensed as occurring again in the present. This typically occurs in the form of vivid intrusive images or memories, which are the definition of flashbacks, which are accompanied by strong emotions and physical sensations. And that these can vary from mild, there is a transient sense of the event occurring again in the present, to severe, there is a complete loss of awareness of present of surroundings. Re-experiencing may also occur in repetitive dreams or nightmares that are thematically related to the traumatic event. So let's resolve the issue about saying what particular kinds of intrusive memories are important. What do we mean by flashbacks? Okay. The second core element, deliberate avoidance. This is be very familiar to everybody. The symptoms are already there in DSM-4, and they now form their own cluster in the proposed DSM-5. So internal avoidance of thoughts and memories, external avoidance of situations and places. And the third core element is the perception of heightened current threat, as indicated by hypervigilance or an enhanced startle reaction to events such as unexpected noises. Hypervigilant persons constantly guard themselves against danger and feel themselves or close others to be under immediate threat, either in specific situations or more generally. They may adopt new behaviors designed to ensure safety, such as sitting in certain places on trains or repeatedly checking in their vehicle's rearview mirror. And it spells out now that there are other commonly occurring symptoms that you may accompany a PTSD presentation, but are not essential for diagnosis, including panic obsessions and compulsions, ruminative thoughts, including preoccupation with the event, general dysphoria in the form of emotional blunting, anhedonia, lack of a perceived future, insomnia, irritability, and concentration problems, dissociative symptoms, suicidal ideation and behavior, and changes in interpersonal attitudes and behavior. So all these are recognized as commonly being part of the symptom picture, but not as being essential for the diagnosis under the new proposals. So just to summarize about the differences with the DSM-5. Guidance about what is a traumatic event is provided, but this is still left to clinicians' discretion, as it was in ICD-10. So there's no formal criterion A. But at the same time, the diagnoser tries to spell out very clearly what kinds of things clinicians should have in mind. The definition is in terms of core elements rather than typical features. And there are only 6 PTSD symptoms in all, 2 re-experiencing, 2 avoidance, and 2 hyperarousal. So that the person to meet the criteria, you have to have at least 1 of the 2 re-experiencing symptoms, at least 1 of the 2 avoidance symptoms, and at least 1 of the 2 hyperarousal symptoms. So that there are 27 different combinations of symptoms that may now result in you qualifying for a diagnosis of PTSD. And although, of course, we have far fewer symptoms, the fact that they are much more specific does not mean that there will be a big change necessarily in the prevalence rates of the disorder. And in fact, some modeling that we've done initially suggests that there will be fairly minor changes in the overall prevalence brought about by these changes. There's no formal cutoff of 4 weeks, and the impairment criterion brings PTSD more into line with DSM-5. So the idea is that, to conclude, that we have here a partial subset of many of the symptoms that we're already familiar with through DSM-4, and that we can identify a more precise subset that can, if you like, pick out the core of this disorder. And this is, of course, is something that's been introduced in conjunction with the notion of complex PTSD, which Marilyn Kloiter will talk about very shortly. And the idea is that ICD-11 hopefully will provide a real contrast to DSM-5, that we will have another formulation which is perhaps is not just useful to clinicians, but will also be useful to us as scientists. It is another way of looking at PTSD. It has some advantages, it will have disadvantages, but we can at least explore now different ways of conceptualizing the disorder and see maybe for scientific purposes as well as clinical ones, this one will prove to be useful in narrowing its focus on a smaller set of symptoms, and we can see what pros and cons that carries with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chris. And as announced, our next presentation will be by Marilyn Kloiter about complex PTSD. Yeah, if you find the right presentation. This one. Here.
Okay. This presentation is about a new disorder called complex PTSD, which emphasizes the theme of ICD-11, which is clinical utility. The proposal presented here is the work of a subgroup that includes myself, Andreas Marker, and Inka Weisberger. And I should note the disclaimer that this proposal is not the official policy of the World Health Organization. Just to emphasize that clinical utility is the organizing principle in the ICD classification development. I found this a very intriguing idea and a new one, and it took a while to absorb and understand. And in the development of a relatively new diagnosis, I thought it was important to really understand what we mean by clinical utility. And there are two ways we can think about clinical utility. First, relates to the characteristics of the diagnostic system as a whole, which means that the metastructure classification of all of the diagnoses have at least two characteristics. One is that they're consistent with clinicians' mental health taxonomies. That means using cognitive science and anthropology and various other ways of thinking about how clinicians intuitively, automatically, and reliably and meaningfully organize ideas about mental health and mental disorders. And secondly, that this classification system be based on distinctions important for management and treatment. The other aspect of clinical utility has to do with the diagnoses themselves, which is that they should overall in the system be small in number. Clinicians have reported they don't like having 100 diagnoses. They don't use 100 diagnoses. They'd rather have about 10. Within the diagnoses themselves, we received guidelines that ideally there should be a limited number of symptoms, something between 3 and 5, which also took me a while to absorb. Lastly, there was a recommendation against the use of subtypes because apparently, again, research has shown in clinician surveys that clinicians do not use subtype information. They stop looking after they get down to the diagnostic major characteristics. So we absorbed this information and thought about complex PTSD. The other aspects of the diagnosis in regards to clinical utility is that it should facilitate communication, easy meaningful, transparent to symptoms, have good implementation characteristics, that is, clinicians see the symptoms in the patients as they are written in the document, and lastly, the diagnosis is easy to use and make. All right. So the complex PTSD diagnosis that we're talking about is really derived from an existing diagnosis in ICD-10, which is called Enduring Personality Change Associated with Catastrophic Events. It was apparently not given too much attention and really did not have much scientific investigation around it. This is the ICD-10 diagnosis for EPCAP, which is following a catastrophic or excessive prolonged stressor. Individuals feel chronically on edge. They have hostile and mistrustful attitudes towards the world. They engage in social withdrawal. They feel estranged from others, and they feel a sense of emptiness and despair. And all of these symptoms must be present for at least 2 years. This was part of a personality disorder, trait-like symptoms. So one of the changes that we have proposed is a revision in the meta-classification. This occurred at a level beyond our particular work group. There were negotiations, and EPCAP was removed from the personality disorder section of the ICD and given to the stress and trauma work group. And so the question became, where does this particular disorder fit into the continuum of our disorders of stress? And here is the list of our disorders to date: acute stress reaction, adjustment disorder, PTSD, prolonged grief disorders, and EPCAC, which we placed along a continuum of characteristics of the chronicity of the disorder, as well as what is sometimes called the recalcitrance to treatment, taking longer to treat. And then the question became, what do we really mean by personality features or trait-like features? And there were two characteristics within ICD that guided our decision-making. One is that they're trait-like in the sense that the symptoms are persistent across time and pervasive across different situations, which is very different from how Chris Bruin was talking about PTSD, which is very linked specifically to traumatic stimuli and the traumatic stressor. The other aspect of personality disorders in ICD is that they are identified as having disturbances in three key domains: affective, self, and interpersonal dysfunctions. So given all of this information, we put together a diagnosis which included the three basic clusters of PTSD, re-experiencing, avoidance, and hyperarousal, and added to it the three domains of trait-like symptoms related to affective dysregulation, negative self-concept, and interpersonal disturbances. So they're basically six symptom sets. There was a lot of discussion about changing the name from EPCAP to complex PTSD, and the decision was made because EPCAC became related to PTSD in that it incorporated explicitly all of the PTSD symptoms. Why did we do this? Certain pilot data that I'd looked at identified the first symptom, which is a chronic sense of threat, using a BSI factor, where it became clear that of these 358 people, all of those who met a clinical cutoff for chronic sense of threat, many had PTSD, met the diagnosis for PTSD. And by many, I mean 93% of people above the clinical cutoff. So it seemed very reasonable to create a kind of efficiency in our system to change the chronic sense of threat to the actual PTSD symptoms. Secondly, as Chris was saying, there is no really huge specific identification of a particular type of stressor. The system is organized such that the gate criterion is any traumatic stressor. and then the diagnosis of PTSD or complex PTSD is solely based on the symptom profile, not the history, which is a very big change and avoids a lot of arguments that have been going on for quite some time about the difference between PTSD and complex PTSD. This is the definition in ICD-11 of complex PTSD. It is the PTSD symptoms and along with it, affective problems, a disturbed sense of self, and persistent difficulties in sustaining relationships. Affect, as Chris has mentioned, these are guidelines describing a range of types of problems. Affective problems are heightened emotional reactions to minor stressors, violent outbursts, reckless or destructive behaviors, dissociation, emotional numbing. Disturbed sense of self is really a negative self-concept with an emphasis of a sense of a defeated, diminished, or worthless self. And lastly, persistent difficulties in sustaining relationships really emphasize difficulties in maintaining relationships, in feeling close to people. That's enough. So given that one of the main problems with complex PTSD and EPCAP in particular was the extreme lack of data, and therefore lack of interest in this disorder, we began looking at archival data to develop a pilot analysis, a latent profile analysis, looking at the proposed complex PTSD disorder symptoms compared to PTSD. And it was the case that I lived in New York City and lived through 9/11 and at the time ran a clinic. And what you see here are over 302 patients who had entered our clinic between 2000 and 2005. Some of them came in because of 9/11-related problems, specifically seeking treatment for 9/11. And another stream of patients were people who had experienced child abuse and were interested in treatment for that. And what you will see here in the latent class analysis is a model of three different classes of individuals coming to the clinic, two of whom have PTSD symptoms as defined by Chris Bruin, with a group that's very low in these types of symptoms, and two groups that are high in these symptoms. One group branches off and becomes high in problems related to affective expression, negative self-concept, and interpersonal disturbances, while the other group is very diminished in these kinds of symptoms, indicating that we have at least three distinct groups. Lastly and importantly, we eliminated the 125 people who met criterion for borderline personality disorder, indicating that the complex PTSD symptom profile can stand independently of borderline personality disorder. What is interesting that you'll see is that really history was not a significant differential predictor of treatment. There were many people in the complex, 27% of people in our complex PTSD group who were 9/11 seeking individuals and who viewed 9/11 as their worst trauma, while many, the predominant had childhood interpersonal violence. It was the case that a logistic regression, however, did find any history of childhood interpersonal violence, yes versus no, as a predictor of complex PTSD versus not. That 9/11 as the worst trauma was a predictor of not having complex PTSD, but rather having PTSD. That all of these symptoms together significantly predicted functional impairment. And so in summary, we are gathering some data to develop a foundation for further consideration that complex PTSD is now intuitively placed in the metacategorization scheme as a sibling to PTSD, that the types of symptoms are conceptually and intuitively organized, the number of symptoms are limited, there are different classes of patients identified between the two disorders, there are different antecedents, that is, types of trauma history as a risk factor, and there are different levels of functional impairment. It is yet to be seen whether we need different types of treatment or treatment durations or different types of interventions. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. And now it's a pleasure, and for us, the members of the working group as well, kind of a very interesting situation to have as discussant the chair of the DSM-5 committee on this group of disorders, Matt Friedman, please.
Well, good afternoon. I want to thank Andreas for inviting me to participate in this panel. I only have 5 minutes because we're really interested in hearing from you. I could obviously talk for 3 hours since I've been living the DSM-5 for longer than I care to admit publicly. I think in the spirit of what Chris Bruin said, I think there's no question that ICD-11 will provide a real contrast to DSM-5. And I think that's good because there's a lot of questions that we don't have. Let me just say a word or two about the DSM-5 process, and that is that it was basically a very conservative process. The DSM-4 was considered the holy book. And we had to have a really good amount of evidence to warrant a change. And even though we all know, those of us that were involved in DSM-4, how non-empirical so many of the recommendations were made, that once they made it to DSM-4, they were there. Maybe not in stone, but at least in some hard substance that was chiseled or cut or something like that. And as a result, and I'll start with complex PTSD, as Marilyn said, there was a paucity, in fact, a shocking lack of decent research on complex PTSD. When I took this job, I really was very eager to see how much had been researched on complex PTSD, and there was nada. That was of a little bit, but not much. And even though the construct has been very strongly embraced and taken up, frankly, there was not sufficient evidence to warrant looking at that diagnosis. Secondly, PTSD has changed in a number of ways, and now I'm going to merge my discussion. It's kind of interesting. Chris Bruin is a double agent, having served on both the DSM-5 and the ICD-11, always with tact and always with rigor. What Chris has looked like you've successfully gotten into ICD-11, you also proposed for DSM-5, which was a minimalist approach, to just include those symptoms that distinguish PTSD from mood disorders, from other anxiety disorders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The decision was made was the opposite of that, and that was that we wanted to have a disorder, we wanted to have a set of criteria that really characterized a PTSD, and what that meant was that the 17 DSM-4 symptoms have now expanded to 20 symptoms. And the attempt so that the diagnostician, when he or she is looking at a patient who may have PTSD, is really going to assess all of the different kinds of domains that how the PTSD might be expressed. What you've done, it's interesting that although in one way there's a big contrast, in other ways there isn't, because almost all of the symptoms that we've all agreed are important are there. They're just in different piles. You've got this associated but non-mandatory pile, which includes almost all of the symptoms that we've put in. Our numbing cluster has now morphed into something we call negative mood and cognitions. So it's a very different, and I think this is very exciting, actually. It's a very different way of challenging the diagnostician. Furthermore, what has been added to PTSD in the DSM-5, which really gets into some of the, I remember, I think it was last year when we had a presentation on DSM-5, and I think Bessel van der Kolk came up to me and said, you know, PTSD is becoming more desnosish, and it is, by including the cognitions, and more importantly, what we've added since then is a dissociative subtype. There's very, very good evidence. There's different fMRI data. There's different predictions of treatment response, and Marilyn Kloitra's work has been part of that. There's different other kinds of factor analytic stuff, so that we have basically gone the opposite direction. We've, in addition to adding a few symptoms to better characterize some of the stuff that we felt was left out, we've also included a dissociative subtype for people who show dissociative symptoms on top of. So in many ways, I think that the distinction between the complex PTSD construct going into the DSM-5 and what has coming out on the other side, I think that these distinctions are much fuzzier. As many of you know, there was a special issue of Journal of Traumatic Stress devoted to this, and Patty Riesig wrote a paper with a lot of commentary arguing that the differences between complex and the PTSD is one of severity. It's a quantitative, not a qualitative difference. I happen to believe that is the case. I also happen to believe that we're going to have some really good, solid research to find out whether I'm right or whether the ICD group is right, and I think that that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing for the field. I think it's a good thing that we can sharpen our constructs. Is my 5 minutes up? Is it time for me to sit down? He's going to give me one more minute. I want to say just one thing about the reactive attachment disorder, disinhibited social engagement disorder. I think there's some really interesting differences in that you're extending this beyond childhood, whereas we're restricting it more to childhood. On the other hand, what's happening in DSM-5, on the other hand, is that separation anxiety is being extended into adulthood. So it's really interesting how different groups are looking at the same data, the same clinical information, coming to different conclusions, and I think it's going to, frankly, enrich both the clinical encounter and the way that we try to understand that. I think that I also thought your discussion about what does it mean to talk about a primary caregiver? I thought that the cultural, the collective issues are things that, to my knowledge, haven't really been addressed as thoughtfully as you all have done it. And finally, I think that the way that the metastructure of the ICD and the DSM has changed, given the freedom of moving from a 10 chapter nosology to a 24 chapter, I think has been very, very important. And the reason why PTSD is no longer an anxiety disorder technically is because we recognize that although the fear-based traditional phenotype is still there, there's also a dysphoric anhedonic subtype, which gets into the desnosis domain. And there is the thing that I think has been neglected heretofore, but has been in complex, is the externalizing stuff, the reckless behavior, the suicidality, the irritability. So I think that we have some real contrasts now, it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. And the good thing, because I don't think, Michael, you mentioned that, and I think it's really important, is that one of the reasons why DSM-5 the 5 is Arabic rather than Roman, is because this is a living document, this is a work in progress. So what I'm here talking about is DSM-5.1. As the research accrues, there'll be DSM-5.2, 0.3, et cetera. I don't know whether you're doing the same thing in ICD-11. But I think we're not going to have to wait another 14 years for DSM-6 as the research accrues to be able to say, well, maybe we didn't make the right decisions, but we don't have to wait 14 years with it. We can change things as need be. So I'll stop here and I'll look forward to your questions.
Also, my English sometimes is not so good. I would like to say thank you, partner from DSM. for your very constructive comments. And I would, in the spirit you just showed us, I would think it's really interesting for the field to have these two systems and to look for stimulation and yeah, other things which will come out. We still have 4 minutes left, but you know we will have I already announced it. We have a second part of this symposium. And as the discussant of the second symposium will not be here. Some questions, and I see Patty already there, please.
Actually, the thing that startled me most was in the DSM-5, we have dropped A2 criterion because that has not been found to be very predictive, and yet that's the thing that startled me, Chris, is that you've got fear and horror. And I think that leaves out most of our people who are military or from a warrior culture where they have a fight response rather than a flight response. But where they've been trained so much that when they're in combat that they say, I was on autopilot. I didn't feel anything at the time of the trauma, and it wasn't until months or years later when I came home that I felt shame or I felt like I must be a monster or something like that and had guilt and shame and those kinds of things. And you've restricted, it used to be fear, helplessness, and horror, and we thought that that wasn't actually capturing it. Now you've got only fear and horror, and I think, you know, I think it's an error.
I would like to ask you for a short comment, and then we have two others, and then it's over for the first part of the symposium.
Just to say that I agree with that, because the fear and horror is not part of the event. It's not important that people experience it during the event. It's part of the symptoms, and this reflects a sort of shift from a lot of emphasis on the event now to more emphasis on the symptoms.
But a lot of people with PTSD don't have fear.
Yeah. Well, I think fear is an important element of that, and along with other emotions as well. And we do explicitly recognize the importance of other emotions, but often in conjunction with fear or horror.
I may add that it's narrowing of the diagnosis. It may come out that some of the patients we now got with PTSD will be better diagnosed with adjustment disorders. But it will be subject to our next symposium. Bessel.
Very exciting process. There's one thing. When we did the field trials for DSM-4, complex PTSD, DESNOS versus PTSD, we found that a substantial number of people with complex PTSD did not meet criteria for PTSD. And so what I see in the new ICD-10 is that you do have PTSD criteria. Also in the data set of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, 82% of our kids don't meet criteria for PTSD, but they reenact and replay and do their trauma rather than remembering it. So I think that's an issue that remains to be seriously paid attention to, I think.
Marilyn, please take the microphone. Yes.
When I looked at the original DSM-4 field trials on PTSD and DESNOS, I thought I did see that about 90% or more of people who were diagnosed with DESNOS also actually did meet criteria for PTSD. So rather than having two disorders, PTSD plus DESNOS, this sort of efficient diagnostic approach includes the PTSD and the key elements of what was formerly DESNOS.
One other short reply, because I already got signs.
No, this will be short, very short. This gets to part of your comment, Bessel. One thing I didn't mention is we have another subtype in DSM-5, and it's a preschool subtype for kids 6 and under. And what you have there is a lowering of the diagnostic threshold because of the very, very low prevalence of PTSD in this population, so that at least for that group, the prevalence is clearly going to increase because the threshold has been lowered. And the reason for lowering the threshold is so many of the subjective, you know, a three-year-old can't really tell you about a foreshortened future. So that's gone for this particular subtype.
Thank you very much. Last question.
Yeah, a short question. I think I have more concerns than excitement about this contrast in crossing the Atlantic and you suddenly have a different disease. Sorry, guys, I don't think it's good. But we'll work on that. But my concern is more, have you looked at how this works for children in the ICD-11? My concern is that children in this system will not be seen, that traumatized children would not have the diagnosis. And I wonder if you have looked at that specifically.
I may answer, and Cecil, you also can. We did not have time today to show you that, for example, in each category, PTSD, complex PTSD, and all the others, we have a developmental presentation section. And there, in this developmental presentation section, there are guidelines, for example, to diagnose PTSD adapted to childhood states. I would like to guide you towards the homepage. I will give it to you in the second symposium as well, and you could look for the guidelines for the developmental presentation.
Yeah, but I'm thinking more of the criteria that you chose.
Okay.
Have you had a child perspective of those? Doesn't seem to me you have had that.
Yes, we didn't include subtypes like in the DSM-5, but we have included some of the recent evidence about childhood developmental variation in PTSD, especially for preschooler, the whole issue of reenactment being a major issue, and for adolescent, the acting out and risky behavior also as example of these variations. So I think there are some parallel, except that these are not subtypes in our cases, but included within the whole clinical presentation.
Thank you very much for being here. And in 10 minutes from now, the second symposium will begin. Almost 11 minutes from now.